It's time to learn something now on RN Drive, or at least the pretense of something, because it's time once again for a bluffer's guide. And Zoe Norton Lodge joins us in the studio as always. Zoe, what are we going to pretend to know about this week?
Today I thought we'd pretend to know about The Sound and the Fury by William Faulkner.
Good, because as it happens, I have not read The Sound of Fury.
Just like always.
The Sound and the Fury, indeed. I can't even get the title right. But obviously it's a pretty seminal work, the sort of thing that you might want to seem intelligent about. What can you tell us?
Well, we'll just start with Faulkner, like we usually start with the man or
yep.
lady.
Okay.
So Faulkner was a Mississippi man. He was born in 1897 and grew up to be a very short fellow and also
okay.
a very good writer.
Okay, yeah.
In extremely unlikely circumstances.
Because he was short.
Because he was short, and also because during the Great Depression, Faulkner, a guy who never finished high school, mm-hmm. was facing crazy financial ruin and trying to raise an ever-growing family in the poorest state in the nation. And while all that was happening, he wrote all these novels, including Absalom, Absalom, and The Sound and the Fury, two of the greatest and trickiest books in the American canon.
Right, so he was pretty good at multitasking.
Yeah, he's sort of like one of those horrible overachievers, Faulkner, you know, those guys.
I know him as a figure of literature. Was he recognised and praised in his lifestyle?
Yeah, he was incredible. And he, you know, he won a Nobel Prize. He wrote lots and lots of novels. He was amazing and had a terrible, you know, faced terrible adversity. So Faulkner died of a heart attack in 1962. Hated by his neighbours and largely ignored by the general public for most of his life, but also considered the greatest American writer of the 20th century.
Happy days.
Why do we care about The Sound and the Fury?
Well, indeed, and I suppose the answer to that question is because someone might ask us about it and we want to look smart.
That's right.
But is there another reason?
Well, I think the reason we care about The Sound and the Fury is because Jean-Paul Sartre cared a lot about The Sound and the Fury.
Fair enough too.
And we should probably care about the things he cares about.
Okay.
So part of the reason he cared about it so much is because of what Faulkner said about language in The Sound and the Fury, which was essentially like a big modernist kind of proposal, which was that language is not capable of articulating exactly what we want to say.
Oh, it sounds like any episode of Friday Drive.
Exactly.
Totally incapable of articulating what we actually want to say.
Yeah.
All right, so as a guy whose tool of trade is language, he's pretty down on the stuff.
He's kind of down on it. And so, you know, basically the point was like whatever words you choose, the full and total meaning in your mind will never quite come out of your mouth and go into somebody else's mind in exactly the same way. We're kind of playing Chinese whispers.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm with him on that.
Yeah, and so in The Sound and the Fury, Faulkner manipulates language in extremely difficult ways to make it really, really hard to understand to kind of prove this point.
That might help the bluffer, though, because presumably it's so hard to understand.
Definitely.
That you can you kind of free associate it a bit
yeah,
in your interpretation?
Of course, you always can do that. That's fine.
All right, well, talk us through it then. What do I need to know? What else do I need to know about
okay,
The Sound
cool.
and the Fury?
So let's just go through the plot. Quick rundown yep. of The Sound and the Fury. So it's all about the Compson family,
okay.
and they're in an epic rut. The kids are feral, the mum is a Bible-obsessed recluse who doesn't really get out of bed, and the dad is an alcoholic who rattles around alone in a den. So it's, you know, it's the American dream. and The Sound and the Fury is sort of about the dire hopelessness of the three Compson brothers as they try to process the fact that their sister Caddy is gone. So
okay.
Caddy had an unhappy marriage, she had a baby very young and was very much sort of ostracised and gone before the novel begins.
All right.
And each chapter in the novel is told from the perspective of a different brother.
Oh, I see. And so that's where we kind of get into the, you know, what you can communicate with language because each one's in a different voice. That kind
exactly.
of thing.
So we start with Benji, who is the youngest and he's mentally handicapped.
Wow, that's going to make things easy for the reader.
Exactly. And so basically Benji bides his time wandering around town and spying on golfers. He likes to listen to golfers talking because they always talk about their caddies and it reminds him of his sister, Caddy.
Caddy. Okay,
right?
I gotcha.
So that makes sense. And then this chapter kind of goes back and forth in time as Benji's gets his memories in order. And just when you think you've gotten on the same page as Benji, who is extraordinarily difficult to understand, we go on to the next brother, Quentin Compson. And now Quentin went to Harvard. And
okay, so that's sounding like maybe he's a little bit more comprehensible?
Well, no, he's actually worse. If Benji's chapter is extremely difficult, Quentin's is sort of stupidly difficult
wow.
to understand. So Quentin, he goes to Harvard. He's also completely obsessed with his sister, Caddy, and he does some pretty stupid things, like he tries to break his father's watch to stop time, and by the end of his section, he tries to top himself in a river.
Right, okay, and Benji's the one who's got a few mental issues.
Exactly, yeah,
wow,
yeah.
Wow, okay, so Quentin's not really doing
Quentin's
so well.
And Quentin's also a bit of an ideas man. So when his sister, Caddy, got pregnant, he had this idea that he would pretend to be the father and cry try incest because he thought that was better than her having had sex with someone who worked in a bank or something.
As you do.
So thankfully nobody agreed. So that didn't happen. So basically on Quentin's day, because each chapter is a different day, essentially, he goes for a long walk, he helps a little girl, he gets beaten up by an old mate, thinks about his sister, and then goes to kill himself.
So this is sounding a bit kind of James Joycean as well, like a Ulysses all set in one day, but we've got four different days here.
Yeah.
Four times harder to understand.
Yeah, absolutely. So...
All right, now, so we got through two of the family.
Yeah, so this is just this is the third brother, and if you're not having fun yet, Jason will fix that because Jason is just horrendous. He's a real piece of work. So he steals from his sister's daughter. He loses money on the stock exchange. He upsets the family servant, Dilsey. He skips out on his work. He chases his sister's daughter around, who seems to have run off with a guy from the circus. That's Jason. And then we get to the final chapter, which is told from the perspective of Dilsey, the servant.
Okay, because I was going to say, we had three brothers. So, what do we do for chapter four?
Well, it's Dilsey the servant, and basically she just makes breakfast and goes to church.
Oh, okay.
So that's all right.
So is that one at least a little bit more comprehensible?
Well, it sort of is, and then we kind of round up the other characters. So Jason runs off to try to find Quentin again and fails, but he does beat up an old man, which makes him happy. And then Benji goes out for a ride in town, but the carriage driver takes him a different route than the one he usually goes on, which Benji does not like at all. And he has a huge tantrum, which makes the carriage go crazy. Then Jason steps in, gets the carriage to go the correct way, that makes Benji happy again. Order restored. See you later, The Sound and the Fury. That's it.
I'm getting the impression from what you've just told us, though, in Norton Lodge, that this is not a novella. This is long.
No, it's quite a piece.
Okay, all right.
Many, many words involved.
Not that I would actually read it, but would I enjoy it, or would I pretend that I enjoyed it if I had? Or would I feel like I've just achieved something so great and painful by reading it?
I think it's a romp. Like, I think it's got a good... It's a fun story. Okay. I mean, fun is probably not quite the right word, but it's a very compelling story. It's just very hard to understand.
Okay, there is a lot going on. Okay, so how can we use The Sound and the Fury now that we've got our bluffing sorted? What sort of context would we use this bluff in?
Well, look, this is what I thought of. Like I was saying, you know, The Sound and the Fury is about how language often fails us in our ability to communicate. Mm. So, you know, sometimes we're all a little bit misunderstood. It happens to me all the time.
Yeah.
I know it happens to you too. So next time you're deeply misunderstood by someone, possibly with the assistance of alcohol or not, might be appropriate to recommend that your interlocutor read The Sound and the Fury and learn that it's not you that's the problem. Even if you're slurring, it's a massive and unfixable shortcoming of language itself.
That sounds very good. And I must say, ideal for Friday drive. Most of our audience, even the ones who are driving, have occasionally had a drink. So The Sound and the Fury is the go-to bluff for all our listeners. Zoe Norton Lodge, thank you very much for making us just that little bit wiser.
No problem.